And now, the big read.
Hello? Yes, speaking. Dead? Yes, 15 minutes. Thanks. Cold, steamy air blew in through two open windows, bringing with it half a dozen times a minute the Alcatraz foghorn's dull moaning. Where Bush Street roofed Stockton before slipping downhill to Chinatown, Spade paid his fare and left the taxicab. San Francisco's night fog, thin, clammy, and penetrant, blurred the street. A few yards from where Spade had dismissed the taxicab, a small group of men stood looking up an alley. Two women stood with a man on the other side of Bush Street, looking at the alley. There were faces at windows.
That was Scott Simon, reading The Maltese Falcon by Dashiell Hammett. Welcome to The Big Read. The Big Read is a program created by the National Endowment for the Arts in partnership with the Institute of Museum and Library Services. I'm Josephine Reed. The largest reading program in American history, The Big Read is designed to unite communities through the transformative joys of literature. And now, here's your host, poet and former chair of the NEA, Dana Gioia.
Today, we'll discuss the classic detective thriller, The Maltese Falcon, by Dashiell Hammett.
He's permanently placed at the top of the pile in the hard-boiled school. Maltese Falcon is, without a doubt, the most widely read, most widely taught, most widely discussed novel of that movement.
It so perfectly represents the 20s and the tough guys of that period, the gangsters, all the things that now belong to history.
The story of the Maltese Falcon is looking for your dreams. And the turn of the Maltese Falcon is, this is something you're never going to find.
What's the point of it all? I mean, that's what the book sort of asks, and that's what's so wonderful about Sam Spade. Is that he laughs. He knows it's all pointless. Love, connection. The only thing that has a point is loyalty to your buddy.
The story of the Maltese Falcon is who killed Miles Archer.
Dashiell Hammett's 1930 novel, The Maltese Falcon, set a new high mark for detective fiction. One to which all serious future writers of the genre would aspire. Not only did Hammett introduce readers to a new kind of hard-boiled hero with Samuel Spade, he also gave us a book that crossed the line from pulp fiction to great literature. Novelist Adrian McKinty.
Maltese Falcon is the story of a detective called Sam Spade, and he's part of this detective agency of Spade and Archer, who are partners, and they have this small office in San Francisco. And into his office one day, a lady comes in who we subsequently learn is called Bridget O'Shaughnessy. And as the story goes on, we discover that she's involved in this nefarious scheme to get this object, this beautiful medieval object called the Maltese Falcon.
Literary critic Maureen Corrigan.
And Spade is also trying to solve the mystery of the death of his partner, Miles Archer. And the two plots seem to intertwine here.
Novelist Walter Mosley.
Hammett is always talking about heroes who are flawed. And so here you have Sam Spade, who's been having an affair with his partner's wife, and his partner gets murdered. And Sam Spade has to figure out where he stands in relation to the world after the murder of this partner who he's cuckolded.
Spade is competing with this group of criminals led by a mastermind named Gutman to try to find the Falcon first. And of course, also along the way, he meets the femme fatale, Bridget O'Shaughnessy.
At the start of the novel, the beautiful Bridget O'Shaughnessy enters Sam Spade's office with a phony story. But it doesn't take him long to learn her real motive for seeking his help. She's desperately trying to recover the priceless Falcon before the others can find it. One by one, Spade meets the criminals who work with, and often against, Bridget. Adrian McKinty.
This is a very motley crew. These are people who you wouldn't ordinarily see together. Gutman is a guy who is obsessed with his own image. He's a bon vivant, a throwback character to the 19th century. Joel Cairo is unctuous and slimy and creepy. And then there's the punk kid Enforcer. And he's very, very young and completely outgunned and outclassed by Spade.
Novelist Diane Johnson knows the setting of the Maltese Falcon well. She lives much of the year in Sam Spade's Fog City.
This book takes place in San Francisco, and it very much evokes the atmosphere of San Francisco with the fog and the hills and the little alleys and the atmosphere of a port with ships coming in, sinister people.
It actually takes place between December 5 and 10, 1928.
Dashiell Hammett's granddaughter, Julie Rivette.
You can walk through the novel, through the streets of San Francisco. You can find the same hotels, the same restaurants, the apartments, the streets.
Writer Joe Gores worked for years in San Francisco as a private detective and repo man. He also wrote the novel Hammett, which was made into a film in 1982.
San Francisco is a very interesting city to have a novel set in because, unlike almost any other major city, there's very little organized crime in San Francisco. Never has been. Back in the 20s, they used to send those guys back to Chicago in the boxcar in a coffin. You know, San Francisco, corruption was local and they wanted to keep it local.
One of the reasons the Maltese Falcon endures today is because of its unforgettable and complicated leading man, Sam Spade, who remains a literary and cinematic icon. Adrian McKitty.
Sam Spade's like a bolt from the blue. He's like nothing you find anywhere else in American letters. Mark Twain started giving us very realistic American archetypes, but I think it was Dashiell Hammett who really presented them in all their authenticity to us.
Joe Gores.
Spade is indeed the epitome of the private detective. The best private detective I know is a guy named David Fetchheimer in San Francisco. Dave always says, Spade is absolutely what a private detective should be, and what we all do sort of think we are. He's the man.
Maureen Corrigan.
We're told in the first paragraph that Sam Spade was a blonde Satan. And right there, you get this mixture with Spade of the hero, but also the devil. I think you could read this novel 1,000 times, and you couldn't say for sure which side of the law Sam Spade is really supposed to be on.
Sam Spade's jaw was long and bony, his chin a jutting V under the more flexible V of his mouth. His nostrils curved back to make another smaller V. His yellow-gray eyes were horizontal. The V motif was picked up again by thickish brows, rising outward from twin creases above a hooked nose, and his pale brown hair grew down from high flat temples in a point on his forehead. It looked rather pleasantly like a blonde Satan.
Walter Mosley.
At the beginning of the novel, Sam Spade has one set of morals, which allows him, for instance, to cuckold his partner without having any disdain for him, really. It's an existentialist book inasmuch as somebody has to make a decision about how they're going to live their life. And Sam Spade does that. And Sam Spade changes. He becomes a different man, even though I think he doesn't believe it's possible to become a different man.
Book critic and NEA Director of Literature, David Kippen.
Hammett was born in 1894 in pretty rural Maryland on his grandfather's farm. Spent a lot of his youth in Baltimore. His father was kind of a ne'er-do-well, and so Hammett himself left school after just, I think, a year of high school and picked up odd jobs. He was a messenger boy for the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. But, I mean, nothing really clicked until he found the Pinkertons.
Julie Rivette.
My grandfather responded to an ad and took a job with Pinkerton's detective agency. It was the kind of job that was really well suited to his intellectual curiosity. He wasn't one to sit behind a desk and do the same thing day after day. Pinkerton's allowed him to go out in the world and experience things that he'd never experienced before. He got to meet all kinds of people, crooks and cops and all kinds of characters. So that kind of work helped him build his repertoire as a detective and as a writer.
Diane Johnson.
Hammett learned a lot from the Pinkerton operative's manual, which he quotes from in some of his early works. He learned a lot about detection and even sort of rough side of law enforcement and struggle.
Joe Gores.
Hammett had been a private eye. He knew what it was like to stand there and say, am I going to die? This guy that's shooting at me. You know, I've been shot at a few times. And you always think, Jesus, my God, you know, you're scared stiff. And he's been there. And very few writers have been there.
Hammett joined the Army during World War I, though serious health problems resulted in an honorable discharge after only 4 months. He moved west, signing up again with the Pinkertons, and finally settled in San Francisco. Hammett suffered from tuberculosis and other respiratory illnesses his entire life, but there was one positive consequence of his poor health. He became an avid reader. He would often joke about trying to read every book in the San Francisco Public Library. Scholar Matthew Bruckley.
Apparently, the seed, the germ, was reading about the Crusades and the Knights of Malta, and the novel grew out of that.
Adrian McKinty discusses the origins of the coveted falcon.
The Knights of Malta made a fortune guarding shipping going through the Mediterranean and through piracy. And because they were granted the island of Malta by the Spanish crown, they decided to give a gift every year to the Spanish crown of this beautifully jewel-encrusted falcon as a token of their gratitude. Unfortunately, the falcon goes missing in the Middle Ages, and then supposedly the falcon turns up in Constantinople in the 1920s. And so there's a lot of art dealers and other ne'er-do-wells are looking for this Maltese falcon. Bridget O'Shaughnessy and the people who are with her think that the falcon has ended up in San Francisco.
Walter Mosley.
Bridget O'Shaughnessy is the classic femme fatale. She knows how to use her beauty and her guile to get men to do what she wants them to do. And every man who falls into that web dies. She represents not evil, but danger.
Sam Spade might be falling for the red-haired bombshell Bridget, but from the start he doesn't entirely trust her. He learns about the missing falcon from Joel Cairo. Soon after, Spade pays Bridget a visit.
The eagerness with which Bridget O'Shaughnessy welcomed Spade suggested that she had been not entirely certain of his coming. "Well, what'll he say?" she asked with half-playful petulance. "He offered me $5,000 for the Black Bird." She started, her teeth toward the end of her cigarette, and her eyes, after a swift, alarmed glance at Spade, turned away from him. "And what did you say?" $5,000 is a lot of money. "But, Mr. Spade, you promised to help me." Her hands were on his arm. "I trusted you. You can't..." She broke off, took her hands from his sleeve, and worked them together. Spade smiled gently into her troubled eyes. "Don't let's try to figure out how much you've trusted me," he said. "I promised to help you, sure, but you didn't say anything about any black birds." "But you must have known, or you wouldn't have mentioned it to me. You do know now. You can't treat me like that." Her eyes were cobalt blue prayers. She lifted her shoulders and hands and let them fall in a gesture that accepted defeat. "It is far more than I could ever offer you if I must bid for your loyalty." Spade laughed. His laughter was brief and somewhat bitter. "That is good," he said, "coming from you. What have you given me besides money? Have you given me any of your confidence, any of the truth, any help in helping you? Haven't you tried to buy my loyalty with money and nothing else? Well, if I'm peddling it, why shouldn't I let it go to the highest bidder? I've given you all the money I have." Tears glistened in her white-ringed eyes. Her voice was hoarse, vibrant. "I've thrown myself on your mercy, told you that without your help I'm utterly lost. What else is there?" She suddenly moved close to him and cried angrily, "Can I buy you with my body?" Their faces were a few inches apart. Spade took her face between his hands and he kissed her mouth roughly and contemptuously. Then he sat back and said, "I'll think it over."
Joe Gores discusses a memorable scene in which Spade searches Bridget's apartment looking for the Black Bird. Although he becomes romantically involved with his client, Spade refuses to let love get in the way of doing his job thoroughly and professionally. Joe Gores.
Everybody puzzled over the fact, why did Spade sit down and have a cup of coffee in Bridget's apartment after he had searched it? Why would he do that? It's a vicious thing to do, blah, 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 blah. I said, no, he was establishing dominance. When I was a repo man, if a guy ever left his lunch in his car, I ate it. I ate your lunch, buddy. You know, that's the thing. And that's what he was doing. He was literally eating Bridget's lunch. He was establishing control.
You're listening to The Big Read from the National Endowment for the Arts. Today, we're discussing The Maltese Falcon by Dashiell Hammett. Dashiell Hammett's hard-boiled hero, Sam Spade, comes from a long line of fictional detectives, though none of Spade's predecessors were anything like him. Crime writer Adrian McKinty.
If you look at the English detectives, Conan Doyle, you've got Sherlock Holmes, and you've got Miss Marple. This is the 1920s. Dorothy L. Sayers characters and Agatha Christie characters, and they're gentlemen detectives or amateur detectives. Sam Spade is completely different from those guys. He's hard-bitten, he's hard-nosed, he's brutal, he's cynical.
Hammett is often compared to two other great detective authors, Raymond Chandler and Ross MacDonald. Former private eye, Joe Gores.
Chandler saw the private detective as a knight. Down these mean streets, a man must go who is not himself mean. Ross MacDonald saw him as a social worker. He's always trying to figure out how to help somebody. The Hammett hero is a guy who does his job, and he follows his own rules of conduct.
Adrian McKinty.
I really like the way Spade takes command of every single conversation that he's in. The police may be accusing him of murder. They may be accusing him of double murder. He may have a gun pointed at him. He may be about to be clobbered on the head by a hood. And yet, Spade is in command of the conversation.
In the opening pages, Miles Archer and the mysterious Thursby are shot dead. The police suspect Spade might be the killer. He's eventually called into the district attorney's office for an informal talk.
Who killed Thursby? Spade said, I don't know. Brian rubbed his black eyeglass ribbon between thumb and fingers and said knowingly, perhaps you don't, but you certainly could make an excellent guess. Maybe, but I wouldn't. The district attorney raised his eyebrows. I wouldn't, Spade repeated. He was serene. My guess might be excellent, or it might be crummy, but Mrs. Spade didn't raise any children dippy enough to make guesses in front of a district attorney, an assistant district attorney, and a stenographer. Why shouldn't you, if you've nothing to conceal? Everybody, Spade responded mildly, has something to conceal. Spade's lifted lip showed his eye tooth. I thought this was an informal talk. My clients are entitled to a decent amount of secrecy. Maybe I can be made to talk to a grand jury, or even a coroner's jury, but I haven't been called before either yet, and it's a cinch. I'm not going to advertise my client's business until I have to. Then again, you and the police have both accused me of being mixed up in the other night's murders. I've had trouble with both of you before. As far as I can see, my best chance of clearing myself of the trouble you're trying to make for me is by bringing in the murderers all tied up. And my only chance of ever catching them and tying them up and bringing them in is by keeping away from you and the police because neither of you show any signs of knowing what in hell it's all about. He rose and turned his head over his shoulder to address the stenographer. Getting this all right, son? Or am I going too fast for you? The stenographer looked at him with startled eyes and replied, No, sir, I'm getting it all right. Good work, Spade said and turned to Brian again. Now, if you want to go to the board and tell them I'm obstructing justice and ask them to revoke my license, hop to it. You've tried it before and didn't get you anything but a good laugh all around. He picked up his hat. Brian began, But look here, Spade said, and I don't want any more of these informal talks. I've got nothing to tell you or the police, and I'm goddamn tired of being called things by every crackpot on the city payroll. If you want to see me, pinch me or subpoena me or something, and I'll come down with my lawyer. He put his hat in his head and said, See you at the inquest, maybe, and stalked out.
Critics disagree whether Hammett or Hemingway first developed the crisp, understated style that's associated with their writing. Though no one knows the answer, one thing's for sure. The Maltese Falcon is quintessential hard-boiled fiction. Julie Rivette.
Hard-boiled fiction has at its heart a tough guy, a protagonist who's making his way through a dark world.
It's like diamonds. His work doesn't shatter, things glance off it. It's hard.
The defining attribute of hard-boiled is cynicism.
This is tough, punchy, terse prose.
There's no floweriness.
I like to say it's like a 7-minute egg.
You crack them, but they don't fall apart. And I suppose that's a characteristic of Hammett's heroes.
Hard-boiled only really works in America.
Adrian McKinty.
You know, America is a diverse, new, bursting, violent, dark, beautiful country. Where you've got the collision of all those forces coming together, especially newness. Newness brings the rich to the bottom and it elevates the poor to the very top. You can be a self-made success or a self-made failure in America. Americans think about the future, whereas in Europe, they think about the past all the time. Hard-boiled is a stance that looks towards tomorrow with a slightly optimistic but also slightly weary, cynical eye.
The Maltese Falcon is interrupted by a brief story within a story. It's the tale of a case Spade once worked on when he was searching for a missing man named Flitcraft. David Kippen.
Spade tells what's come to be called the Flitcraft parable to Bridget O'Shaughnessy. It's the story of a guy who basically drops out of his life, and nobody knows quite why until Spade bumps into him years later and gets the story.
Maureen Corrigan.
He said he was walking down the sidewalk one day, and a beam fell from a construction site and almost hit him and killed him.
Doesn't hurt him, except maybe a chip in the concrete bounces up and nicks his cheek. That's the only visible scar. But of course, the invisible scar is that he's been, well, in Hammett's phrase, he felt like somebody had taken the lid off life and let him look at the works.
And that's when Flitcraft realized he needed to change his life, deserted his wife and children.
Julie Rivette.
He suddenly realized that life was not orderly and planned the way that he'd thought that it was. So he decided to align himself with that new worldview, and he took off and changed his life at random.
He went to Seattle that afternoon, Spade said, and from there by boat to San Francisco. For a couple of years, he wandered around and then drifted back to the Northwest and settled in Spokane and got married. His second wife didn't look like the first, but they were more alike than they were different. You know, kind of women that play fair games of golf and bridge and like new salad recipes. He wasn't sorry for what he had done. It seemed reasonable enough to him. I don't think he even knew he'd settled back naturally into the same groove he'd jumped out of in Tacoma. But that's the part of it I always liked. He adjusted himself to beams falling, and then no more of them fell. And he adjusted himself to them not falling.
Walter Mosley.
The story within a story is the heart of the novel. The dream he's chasing is also the life that he once led. And I think that that story gives Spade his understanding of the world.
The Maltese Falcon was a terrific success.
David Kippen.
This was the book that pretty much did what I think Hammett all along intended for it to do, which was to elevate the detective story to the realm of literature.
Matthew Bruckley.
It's a world classic that has entered the knowledge of every literate person in the English-speaking world and most of the others. Enormously, prodigiously influential book.
Although The Maltese Falcon was adapted for the screen 3 times, it was the last version in 1941 that became a classic. It also launched 3 famous film careers. Leading man Humphrey Bogart had his breakthrough role. The corpulent stage actor Sidney Greenstreet announced his presence on the silver screen. And John Huston made his directorial debut. David Kippen.
You would be hard-put to point to another American literary classic that resulted in a movie of such great distinction as The Maltese Falcon. It's a terrific adaptation, which on the one hand is very faithful. I mean, the joke about it for years was that Huston tossed a copy of the paper back to his secretary and said, change the margins on this over the weekend because we want to start shooting on Monday. Well, of course, that is absurd. It also, many have said, more or less invented film noir, the idea of dark, sordid, frequently crime-driven American stories in black and white.
Hammett published all five of his novels within the span of only 5 years. Once he reached 40, he never published another serious work, even though he lived to be 66. The chronic illnesses that had plagued Hammett for most of his life finally killed him in 1961. Toward the end of the novel, the criminals who have been tirelessly searching for the Maltese Falcon finally have the bird within their grasp. Walter Mosley.
It's the dingus. There's always a dingus. There's something that we're looking for, the something or someone that's lost. And this one, it's the Maltese Falcon. It's the dingus. And the wonderful thing is that's what Sam Spade calls it. He says, so we got the dingus here. Everybody's talking about how it's worth all of this money, but he just sees it as the thing that's holding this caper together, basically. It stands for all the dreams of all the characters except for Sam Spade.
Early morning in San Francisco, Spade and the criminals patiently wait in his apartment. The doorbell rings. Spade opens the door to find Effie Perrine, his endlessly faithful secretary, his invaluable angel, holding the dingus wrapped in brown paper. The criminals stir with anticipation.
Spade shut the door and carried the parcel into the living room. Gutman's face was red and his cheeks quivered. Cairo and Bridget O'Shaughnessy came to the table as Spade put the parcel there. They were excited. The boy rose, pale and tense, but he remained by the sofa, staring under curling lashes at the others. Spade stepped back from the table, saying, "There you are." Gutman's fat fingers made short work of cord and paper and excelsior, and he had the black bird in his hands. "Ah," he said huskily, "now, after 17 years. His eyes were moist. Cairo licked his red lips and worked his hands together. The girl's lower lip was between her teeth. She and Cairo, like Gutman and like Spade and the boy, were breathing heavily. The air in the room was chilly and stale and thick with tobacco smoke. Gutman set the bird down on the table again and fumbled at a pocket. "It's it," he said, "but we'll make sure." Sweat glistened on his round cheeks. His fingers twitched as he took out a gold pocket knife and opened it.
Thanks for joining The Big Read. This program was created by the National Endowment for the Arts in partnership with the Institute of Museum and Library Services. It was written and produced by Dan Stone. Readings from The Maltese Falcon were by Scott Simon. Honey, performed by Jay McShann, used with permission of Chiaroscuro Records. Also from Chiaroscuro Records are Milt Hinton's Time After Time and Time on My Hands, as well as It Don't Mean a Thing and Slap Happy, featuring Lionel Hampton. John Barry's main titles from the film Hammett, courtesy of Len Friedman Music. Instrumental selections from the original score to the film Brick by Nathan Johnson and the Cinematic Underground, used with permission of Nathan Johnson and Chop Logic Music. Thanks to Pop Sound, Santa Monica, California, for the sound effects. Special thanks to Matt Fitzhenry, Carolyn O'Keefe, Pepper Smith, Ken Huffman, Erica Koss, Adam Campy, and to our contributors, Matthew Bruckley, Maureen Corrigan, Joe Gores, Diane Johnson, David Kippen, Adrian McKinty, Walter Mosley, and Julie Rivette. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm Dana Gioia.
For more information about The Big Read, go to www.neabigread.org. That's www.neabigread.org.